Yo everyone, welcome back to Brand New Tech-ish. I'm back again, I'm Michael Behane, and I'm joined with the amazing
Abadesi.
Woo, Brand New Tech-ish. I'm so excited.
Me too. Cool.
Should we do the first story?
Yes, please.
Let's go. So Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, I'm not sure if he's the co-founder, but he's definitely the most prominent founder.
Yeah, I think he and his wife Jessica Livingston started it together.
Cool. Yeah, that's why I wanted to make sure I wasn't missing anybody out. So obviously he's a very prominent person in tech, so what he says kind of holds a lot of weight. So he sent out a tweet that kind of sent a lot of mouth chattering. He said, the next time someone claims that starting startups is for rich kids, remind them that Airbnb happened because its founders literally could not pay their rent. Cue absolute insanity. Everyone's in the comments talking about this, that, and the third. I'm seeing like other blue ticked entrepreneurs saying, no, that's not true, blah, blah. And then Paul Graham's like, yo, man, I had enough of your bullshit, blah, blah, blah. It's got a real thing. So let's debate the merits of that actual statement.
Okay.
How does that feel to you? Does that ring true? He's basically saying you don't have to be a rich kid to do a startup. Yes or no?
Do you have to be rich to do a startup? I mean, a homeless man can start a startup if he wants.
It's not going to go nowhere.
Right? I mean, if you know, if the question is, you know, who can start a startup?
Yeah.
The answer is anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, whether or not that startup succeeds or even turns over $1 of revenue is a completely different thing. This isn't the first time Paul Graham said problematic stuff on social media.
Yeah.
And the reason why I find it concerning and problematic is because this is one of the most well-respected guys in the tech world.
Yeah.
And what it shows to me is just how nuanced understanding of privilege is.
Right.
And I think the more privileged you are, the harder it is for you to really understand the experiences mm-hmm. of underprivileged people.
Mm-hmm.
So what is his definition of rich, right? He says that the Airbnb founders couldn't pay their rent at the time of starting up the startup.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that might be the case, but even rich people struggle to pay their rent sometimes. It doesn't mean they don't have money or access to resources. It just means that timing or circumstances are such that you find yourself in a difficult situation.
Yeah.
That's actually quite different to being like financially struggling and not having access to any resources. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, because you could be temporarily broke, but then you can go back to your mum and dad and all of a sudden they're putting you into Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
So you're rich in resources, rich in connections.
You could also be cash poor and asset rich.
That's another thing, yeah.
Like, I remember when I used to be in a flat share and one of my flatmates was like, oh God, I'm broke. And I was like, oh, like, do you need to borrow money? And she's like, oh, no, that's okay. I just feel broke when my current account falls below 1K.
Wow.
And I was like, what?
Come off it, fam.
I was like, no. Broke is when you're at the bottom of your overdraft, you've maxed out all your credit cards, your parents don't pick up the phone anymore because they know you want money and they're not going to give it to you.
Yeah.
I was like, so that's broke to me. So I think what this really showed was, you know, when you are a billionaire, basically, or like a multi-millionaire, your idea of what it is to be rich and broke becomes quite warped because you're just so far from the poverty line. You know what I mean? And like what people were saying in their replies was that like 40 million Americans are living in abject poverty.
Yeah.
As in going to food banks,
living
off benefits. So anything that is above that is rich to them, right? Like anyone that can basically afford to eat and have a roof over their head is rich. And, you know, Paul Graham in his response was basically saying, you know, I'm just sick of this meme that like, oh, only rich kids can have successful startups. And it's kind of funny because I talk about this quite a lot here on the podcast where I'm like, look, entrepreneurship is easier the more privileged you are.
Definitely.
So I am totally like in support of this meme that he's trying to fight against. Now, don't get me wrong. There are opportunities for people from underrepresented backgrounds and more marginalized backgrounds to pursue that path. But it doesn't mean they're going to come out successful or make any money
completely
at all. What do you think?
I think just because something is not impossible doesn't mean that it's the reality. Like, it's not impossible for someone who, you know, is relatively in poverty to start a startup. They can do it, but what's the chance of them succeeding and how common is it? Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Also, the funny thing is, you know, in tech we're always like, yeah man, data driven, but this is just anecdote. This is not symptomatic of anything but this one anecdote. And the fact that Paul Graham, who has probably overseen hundreds, maybe even thousands of startups, and he's only just plucking out like one
anecdote.
one piece of data. I'm just like, yeah, one story. I got this one story about this one guy that, I know, I got plenty of stories. You know, I know one guy that smoked 100 cigarettes every day and he lived to 100. Like, there we go. Silk cigarettes are great for you.
Yeah.
That's not proof of anything, right?
Agreed.
Do you know what I mean? I would love to see a more holistic, you know,
it
look at the data of YC founders and say, what are their backgrounds? Then come talk to me. If you're like, oh, most YC founders didn't go to college, or, you know, they their parents didn't go to college, because actually you have a lot of college dropouts.
Yeah.
Yeah. They could go to college, but they choose not to. But what their parents, if most of their parents didn't go to college, like, what's up? And
I think this was just a particularly bad example because one of the founders in question attended Harvard University, not on a full scholarship. So there's obviously a significant amount of wealth that's required to do that.
Yeah.
And also some of the comments revealed that, you know, the founders were also like early investors in Uber.
Yes, you're right. And
so people were like, yo, like, how are you saying you're not
rich? Story's not adding up.
You're like angel investing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like angel investing. Story, have you angel invested in anything? Never. I was like, I mean, maybe a Girl Scout cookie or something. That doesn't really count. So yeah, very, very problematic. But I'd be curious to hear what the audience think. Use the hashtag techish and share your views.
Yeah, so speaking on the subject of rich people or people from a higher social class, there was a really interesting article in the New York Times about why high class people can get away with incompetence.
Mm.
And they looked at studies that showed that people that are of a higher class actually overinflate their actual abilities. They have a higher perception of how good they actually are compared to the reality. But then it also becomes reality because people perceive them to be such and treat them as such.
Right.
So if there wasn't
Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. Right, that's the best example. Like, he just keeps going on about how amazing he is. There's an amazing video I saw where they get all the clips of him saying, nobody knows more about the X than me.
Really?
So, and it's literally a clip of him saying, nobody knows more about building than me. Nobody knows more about trade than me. Nobody
like knows more than
brain. Yeah, literally everything from like brain surgery to like everything. And it's ridiculous. Why? But like, he is, you know, he's the ultimate example of that.
Mm.
But generally speaking, this is like one of these things where if you do come from like a relatively lower, you know, economic status, or your parents do.
Yes.
You just don't have that innate confidence. Of course. Never do. Like, all the people that I grew up with,
gravitas.
Like, yeah, we don't have that. We never had that gravitas to walk into a building and thinking, I deserve to be here.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And like, it would, I think it rubs off on other people. They can tell that you don't feel confident, so therefore they don't treat you with like you're competent. And and there's so much study, so much research into authority. So people look at you know, the Milgram experiments, where they get, you know, a doctor or someone who looks like a doctor, tell somebody, basically commit torture. And do people follow through? They do follow through because we have a bias towards following people that appear to be an authority figure.
Yeah.
So if you're of a lower class and you don't portray yourself as an authoritative figure, people don't listen to you. Whereas the inverse is true. So it's really complicated. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I think it's the same kind of thing. You know, when you're trying to like blag your way into like a VIP party or like blag your way into a members club. If you act like you deserve to be there, the bouncers never stop you. It's only when you're like kind of like shy, peeping around, where they're like, oh, are you on the guest list? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, kind of stuff.
And I think that relates so much to like how we behave as human beings and how we interact with each other. People often say that, I don't know what the percentage is exactly, but something like 80% of communication is nonverbal.
Yeah, 100%.
And, you know, there are all these, like, you know, data points that we're gathering in any interaction as we approach a situation to basically, like, assess someone, assess their credibility, assess, you know, how we're going to handle the information that they're giving us. Do we trust them or not?
Mm.
And I think the fact is, capitalism is like a system of oppression, right? So we kind of like grow up in this system where the more money you have, the better your outcomes will be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the more decisions you can make, the more opportunities
completely
you can have. And if from a very young age we're kind of like being exposed to this idea that wealth is good and poverty is bad, then it just means that we then begin to associate wealth with positive traits and associate poverty with negative traits. If you think about here in the UK, like the work that William David Booth, who was like a historian, did with like the poverty surveys in the Victorian era, before he released that research, people assumed that people were poor because they were lazy.
Right.
Like, I mean, this is really like the beginnings of the welfare state. For so long, people were like, oh, you're poor because you're lazy. And he actually did all of this research to kind of prove, whoa, guys, like, this is way bigger than this. There are systemic reasons. There's like, and you know, that's when like the NHS and like welfare state kind of like started to begin. So I think we've seen this trend throughout history, so it's almost not surprising to me that we continue to do that. And I think it's shameful. I mean, I probably fall victim to this, but ultimately it's a bias and ultimately it's a mindset. You know what I mean? Like, ultimately, like, there could be someone who was a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. His fortune changes. Now he's like a homeless man, you know, begging for change on public transport or whatever. he's still the same human being that he was mm-hmm. when he commanded a room full of executives mm-hmm. in the boardroom. And now he's standing here trying to ask me for spare change. Like, it's just so, I don't know, like boggling, mind boggling how we just make these associations when in reality, if we look at the news, the people who are really doing horrible things in the world, the people who are really doing evil in the world are actually really, really wealthy, affluent people.
Yeah.
And yet when it comes to a micro level interaction, like, oh, hey, who should I sit next to on the tube? Who should I sit next to on the bus? Yeah. You're going to try to sit next to the person that ascribes to wealth because you're going to feel safer.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I've always said to my friends, like, people in suits have probably committed more murders than any person, yeah. or at least authorized more murder than any person or group of people in history. If you look at wars and, you know, government and whatever. But when we see someone in a suit, we automatically think competent. We automatically think they know what they're doing, or much more so than a person in a tracksuit or a hoodie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But yeah,
it's funny because I feel like as an not that I'm anti-capitalist,
but you want this money. If you don't want this money, send it to me, please.
I just think, like, ever since graduating in the recession, all that kind of stuff, like, I am, like, so, like, distrustful of, like, people in suits. Like, yeah. I have it the other way. You know what I mean? Like, because we work in tech.
Definitely.
So we kind of can wear what we want. But just earlier today, I was walking through the city of London, like, financial district, and you just see, like,
you think Bush are.
You know, wanker bankers walking around. I have friends that work in finance. I feel so bad saying it, but it's true. When I see the shiny suit, I'm like, what fuckery are you doing at your desk
today? Yeah. Hit, hit.
So, everyone's been talking about the Snapchat gender swap filter. Have you tried it?
I've tried it, yeah. I downloaded Snapchat just to try that. I was like,
you didn't have Snapchat?
I bounced. As soon as Instagram stories came about, that feature, I was like, I'm off. Like,
but Snapchat has such better filters. Are you joking? It does.
But it's like, it's one of those things where you make that kind of trade-off where you're like, is it good enough to keep me? And it wasn't good enough to keep me. As in, like, yeah.
What about YOLO? YOLO, the new app. I don't even know that, man. You can ask your friends questions.
No. It takes a lot for me to download a new app. Like, I always advise founders, like, if your product is an app, make sure there's a compelling ass reason for me to download this app, because I don't want to download any more new apps. But sorry, go on. Yeah, the Snapchat filter.
So, Snapchat gender filter, everyone started having fun, all the memes were going around, everyone's like laughing and joking. Like, the funniest story I saw was where, like, one girl sent a gender swap face to her mom and being like, oh, do you think this guy's hot? He's like, ask me out. And her mom was like, nah, he ugly. She was like, oh, that's me.
You should laugh. I saw your one. You look like an Ethiopian. You look like an East African brethren with a beard. I was like, nah.
I look like your peoples.
You know, my peoples.
I swapped to the other side of the continent when I did mine. I was like, eh, embrace me. But yeah, so interestingly enough, what our privilege blinded us to as cisgender individuals was that this is actually a very, very problematic filter for the trans community.
Yeah.
So I was actually prompted to research this after speaking to someone I know who's trans, basically saying, how would you feel if there was a race swap filter?
Yeah.
Where you could go from black to white?
Yeah.
Side note, Snapchat have made some dodgy filters.
Yeah, they've done that, haven't they? Not black to white, like, but like
maybe more like Asian,
like that. So right, like, side note. And also a lot of their filters kind of also make people look more European. Like, they lighten your skin, they kind of, like, you know what I mean? Like, so it's like they have...
That's quite a popular thing that happens in, like, Japanese photo booths. So for anyone who's listening and has been to, like, Tokyo or Japan, anywhere in Japan, you go in these photo booths and then you, like, apply these filters and then they immediately make your nose thinner and longer and your eyes bigger and, like, make your face narrower.
Listen, man, Eurocentric standards of beauty, they permeate everywhere. It's global.
Crazy.
It's global out here.
But, yeah, so, you know, the trans community found this, like, really problematic just because... This is a very sensitive issue for people basically who aren't cisgender. You know, like, you're born into a body that you don't necessarily identify with, or like you're gender fluid, gender queer, etc. So I guess, like, the question that I'm trying to say is, like, what responsibility should, like, social media platforms or really, like, any technology have when they're creating these, like, augmented reality tools?
I mean, I get it, because I think until I read the article, my privilege kind of blinded me to it. And it's like, I understand why someone's like, don't make my experience into a filter. You see what I'm saying? And I've had to struggle, you know, my whole life, whatever. And you've just made it into a little fun game kind of thing.
Exactly.
And this is why, like, we, both you and me kind of always, you know, push diversity so hard. It's not because, it's just for the sake of it. It's just because we're like, if someone who hasn't had that experience isn't in the room, they're never gonna, it's never gonna get flagged up. I probably wouldn't have flagged it up. I would have been like, yo, this is jokes, like, it's hilarious. And I did have fun with it. Me and you did have fun with it. Until somebody was like, yo, like, this is a bit of an issue, like, this is kind of taking the piss out of my experience. And I think
I think you're right, though. Representation is the key, right?
Completely.
If there are trans people involved, if there are trans people in the team, they're going to be able to flag that and be like, hey, listen, like, this should come with a trigger warning or something. Because this is not cool. This could be problematic with certain individuals.
In the article that you sent me that I read briefly, there was a quote.
So this is the Next Web. The Next Web article.
Cool. Yeah, it'll be linked in the show notes. One of the quotes, I think it was from a trans activist, basically said, this actually might make some people realize that they're more comfortable in a different gender, essentially, and that seeing yourself in this way, I don't know, I can't speak to this, because this is not my experience, and I don't want to speak for anybody who's going through this, but essentially, if you are somebody who might be going through, you might be struggling with your identity, seeing this filter might make you think, well, hold on, this is what I always wanted to be. I'm just throwing it out there, that was in the article, but don't shoot me down, baby.
Yeah.
But like,
they should have had like a non-binary option.
Perhaps, and as people said, also like dichotomy in gender is basically erasing non-binary people.
It could have been like a spectrum.
Right, exactly. But this is the thing, there's a lot of things that I'm ignorant about. I can't speak to this experience. You know what I mean? So, and that's why representation, like you said, is key. So, I completely understand why people would be like, Snapchat, do better. But I mean, on a business level, it's worked for them. Like, I've downloaded their app. There's articles being written about it.
Yeah.
And they've been getting, as a company, pretty much beat up by Facebook non-stop for about maybe 18 months, 2 years maybe, you know what I mean? So they need something. So on a business call, they might just be like, yo, this is what we needed to do, you know. People raise your concerns, shut up, we're not trying to hear it. But interesting stuff. There's an interesting article that I saw on Medium. I think it's an excerpt from an upcoming book. I don't know who the person is. I'll put the link in the show notes. It's called Live versus Dead Players. Essentially, they kind of look at real life and they try to make it into like a video game. And they say that live players are people that are constantly learning new things and are able to do different and new things. Whereas dead players are basically people that can only regurgitate what they've done. They're living off a script that's already been written.
Okay.
And at different times, people can be live or dead. So for example, they say that Apple, under Steve Jobs, was a live player. They were constantly like innovating. They went from Mac to iPhone to iPad, for example. Whereas Apple now is a kind of a dead player in a sense, they're kind of just regurgitating what they've already done, essentially. So where it gets interesting is that he says, or the author says, if somebody's a live player, or somebody's a dead player, if you go on the offensive against them, you know they're only capable of doing what they've already done.
Right.
So you can kind of attack them.
You know their arsenal. You know what they've
completely.
Got.
Completely. And something new will completely throw them off their game, whereas a live player can kind of adapt.
Nice.
He used the example of Putin, saying that Putin's Russia is doing a lot of like live player type stuff. They're attacking Crimea. They're getting involved in elections. They're using cyber warfare, essentially. And they're unpredictable. You don't know what they're going to do. So attacking them, they'll be able to adapt and do something different. It's really interesting stuff. I don't know. It's an interesting framework to look at the world, especially if you're in business, because I'm not talking about like attacking people in real life. I mean, attacking companies.
Okay. Give an example to an early stage founder that's listening. How can they apply it to their life?
That's a good example. So you put me on the spot. I think if you're attacking an industry that is stagnant, more times than not, they're going to be quote-unquote dead players. They're going to be people that are just doing the exact same thing, running off a script, running off what they've always done. If you hear the phrase, this is how it's always been done, then you know there's an opportunity to a certain extent.
Okay.
People often say that education is the next thing to be disrupted because colleges and universities have kind of got fat off the student loans and the fees. None of this means that your startup idea is going to work, but it's an indication to like, you know what I mean, like what's going on. So when Steve Jobs was alive, there was a lot of rumors that Apple was going to do a car. Since he's passed away, Apple's kind of batted it away and said, we're not going to do a car. And I think it's because now, under Tim Cook's stewardship, they just don't have that in them to do something like a complete 180 and do a whole different kind of product and
get
to a
whole,
it's gone, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I'll put the article in the show notes, live versus dead players. Very interesting.
That's super interesting.
So there's something that's been on my mind. You know, there was the whole thing where the billionaire tech investor Robert Smith donated, I think it's up to $40 million to pay off the student loans of one graduating class at Morehouse University, which is a historically black college.
Yes.
Which is amazing. Like,
man, you know, I wish I was sitting in the audience.
Oh, I'd be
can
so gassed.
Can you come pay my student loan debt?
How much do you owe? You want to keep it real? What's the ballpark? Actually, don't say that. I'll say it. They might be listening. They'll be like, okay, you ain't paid us. Yeah, so I think actually it's like 48k per year to go to Morehouse. obviously in the UK, like, it's about, I think I owe, like, I'm never going to go into it anyways. But yeah, like, what are your thoughts? Like, you know, we always kind of talk about philanthropy versus, you know, why does this scenario even exist where people, why is there $40 million worth of debt in that room? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, what this, the whole systemic issue of just, like, burdening young people with such an incredible amount of debt at such a young age before they've even got a foot through the door.
Yeah, it's stupid.
It's stupid. I mean, but I'm interested, obviously, we're applauding what Robert Smith's doing, you know, get interested.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. I don't know, I just think that, like, signalling has to change. I think that we... It's just so difficult that so many, like, structures like employment and careers are still so regimented in how they assign value to individuals.
Yeah.
In the sense it's like, okay, you studied here at there, therefore you are worth this, I'm going to bring you into my organization. Right. I think, like, those are the structures that we need to challenge for people to be, like, economically empowered enough to decide not to go to university and, like, mm-hmm. pursue another career route. More and more people are turning away from university, but it's still too soon to say, like, whether they're still going to, like, across the board, like, maximize their earning potential, mm-hmm. maximize their personal development. You know, capitalism is a system, it is a structure, and the parties with influence kind of, like, all group together to decide how they can interact in order to maximize their own outcomes. And then the reality is that individuals lose out.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know, like, I don't know what will happen. Like, I don't know what I would say to my children, because they're going to be brown, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, it probably will be easier for them to get hired with a college degree
mm-hmm.
than if they didn't. You see what I'm
right,
saying? Because,
yeah.
like, not that much is going to change, realistically,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
over the next, you know, 50,
20 plus
years.
I mean, I think it is changing slowly. I think now
is
more
it,
than
though?
Ever, it's...
But is it?
Yeah, maybe
Let's
you're right.
Let's look at the stats. Let's look
yeah,
at the numbers.
I don't have the data, but you should probably, if we listen to the data of, like, top
positions.
How many
black CEOs?
Yeah,
how many
true.
CEOs with no college degree?
Yeah, that's a good
how
point.
How many venture-backed founders with no college degree who are not white? Or
okay,
who
yeah,
didn't
okay.
drop out of an Ivy
yeah,
League?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
when we actually
me.
Look at the numbers, nothing is changing.
Yeah, we'll talk.
They want us to feel like it's changing. They want us to
people
feel like
trying,
it's changing.
People are trying, but nothing's really changed.
Nothing is changing. Like, until the people, like, who have all the money, who have all the power, like, start to understand the reasons why they need to start changing where they put that money and where they put that power and, like, doing things differently, like, it's not really going to change, and probably a lot of them don't want to.
Yeah, we'll talk. The other thing I wanted to talk about was there was an article I read called Black Capitalism is Not a Solution. I'm paraphrasing the title.
Okay.
Essentially, the author was saying that since Nipsey died, there's been a concerted effort to kind of talk about, you know, buy back the block, you know, promote entrepreneurship. And that's the way that the racial wealth gap can close. Now, the author in the article was basically saying that it's a misnomer, it's a misdirect, that the racial wealth gap was created because of government intervention to prevent the black community and other communities from, you know, accruing wealth, right? So to say that without government intervention that can be fixed is dangerous, basically.
Mm.
To say that, oh, like, you know, we'll do some STEM programs and we'll get people coding and we'll, you know, venture capitalists will come in and risk it a day. Like, it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
And that you need government programs and that there's too much of an emphasis on entrepreneurship. I don't know.
I think that's true.
I think it's true.
This is like what we were talking about before, where, like, if you are interested in entrepreneurship, but you're, like, from some kind of, like, if you're just not super privileged, then you should probably let your employer be your angel investor. I mean, they talk about this a lot at BB Founders. They talk about this a lot at Zebras United. If you're talking about creating wealth, then you actually, like, need to, like, assess the most realistic, least risky way for you to do that. And entrepreneurship is high risk, high reward,
mm-hmm.
which also means low probability of success.
Right.
Right. The majority of people that pursue entrepreneurship end up more broke than if they just stayed in a job, were competent, worked their way up a ladder, got promoted by moving jobs or moving companies or whatever. So I totally agree with that. And I think the other thing is, like, there's that economist, Thomas Piketty, that wrote the book Capital, that was basically saying, like, why do we ignore the fact that if you already have assets, you are accruing wealth? And the reality is, you take a country like America, for example, and what you have on average is a situation where white households have so much more generational wealth, so much more in terms of assets,
mm-hmm.
in terms of what contributes to their wealth, versus black families. So even if we start putting all this money into black entrepreneurship, whatever, it's going to be so long before they can even catch up, if at all they ever will. Do you see what I'm saying?
Completely.
I mean, this is why black people were fighting for reparations, because they were like, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
You have all of these white families that made money off of our ancestors, mm-hmm. who are now like living this opulent life.
Mm-hmm.
We're struggling to escape poverty, and we've never been given anything. And so I just kind of think, like, if you look at it from even just from basic, like, okay, who actually has assets? Let's not talk about cash. Who has money in the bank right now, or who has property, or who has,
mm-hmm.
you know, stocks and shares? And yeah, I don't know, like, to that point of like government intervention and government policy as well, like, look at what's been happening in the Trump government. Like, he's been making policy changes, you know, financial and economic policy changes that ultimately favor people with more money.
Completely.
Right? And all these working class people who are like buying into this narrative of like, oh my God, he's lowering taxes, this is amazing. Like, I just find that crazy, because I'm just like, right, okay. But actually, like, think of where tax money goes.
Mm-hmm.
You are the most vulnerable people,
mm-hmm.
if there are no public services to support you and future generations of your family. Rich people can pay for their own substitutes to public services. So yeah, like, it's so much more complicated than that.
Completely. I agree with you, to be honest. I don't have any real disagreement with what you said. I think it's going to be a multi-pronged strategy. I think entrepreneurship does play a factor, and encouraging it is a net positive.
Mm.
But I think we also have to be realistic and say, like you said, this situation was created through government
intervention. Hundreds of years in the making.
Not even hundreds of years. So, for example, after the Second World War, there was a GI Bill, which basically gave cheap mortgage loans to returning soldiers, but it was deprived to black soldiers. Wow. So a lot of middle class wealth in America, white middle class wealth, was based off the fact that people were given cheap loans,
yeah.
and built their wealth through real estate. Real estate, yeah. is one of the main ways that a lot of people have maintained their family wealth for generations, because not everyone's into stocks. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Most of their wealth is in their house.
Any kind of capital.
And then in the areas where black people did reside, they call it redlining, where they kind of just made the house value just depreciated because they made them into a black area,
yeah.
and whatever, and it was seen as a low value house or whatever. So people were screwed from day.
Mm.
And that has to be unwound. So from the history of slavery onwards to this, that has to be completely unwound, and there has to be some form of reparations as far as I'm concerned. And sooner the better.
Black tax breaks.
Black tax breaks, probably even no college fees, like, do you see what I'm saying? So what Robert Smith done has to be done, but on a governmental level.
And you'll see, even if they do that right now, it's not gonna change anything.
Oh yeah, this is generational.
It's gonna take
This is completely generational.
So
but it's
long.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. I am of the kind of, they call it do for self. I am a do for selfer. It's almost seen as an insult to say that you're a do for selfer. Like, I am a do for selfer. Like, I think.
What's the opposite?
You know, that we have the main thing that we should be focused on is getting the government to fix this issue.
Oh.
I feel like you can walk gum. What's the phrase? Chew gum and walk at the same time. So I feel like...
Is it?
Yeah.
From where?
You never heard that before.
Okay.
Basically, we can do two things simultaneously.
Okay.
There has to be an effort to get the government to fix the wrongs, and there also has to be an effort where we have to say, okay, what's realistic that we can do right now, today? Today is, how do we help people start small businesses? How do we help people get funding? How do we help people, you know, learn to code, etc., etc.? But yeah, interesting topic.
So I welcome to some very positive news this morning.
Whoop, whoop.
Sharmadine Reed,
whoop, whoop.
Founder of Lawnails,
whoop.
And more recently founder of Beauty Stack, has raised £4 million seed funding to help beauty professionals connect with their audience. So it's like part booking, part social media. She's going to transform the beauty market. People spend so long on Instagram, scouting out hairstyles, nail styles. What she's trying to do is just close the loop from browsing to actually purchasing a service. The round was led by Index Ventures.
Amazing.
Almost certainly the largest seed round I know a black woman has raised.
Definitely.
So
at least in London, 100% in London.
Big up.
Big up, 100%. Don't know Black Girl Magic, don't know London.
All right, dear listeners, that brings us to the end of another episode of your favorite tech podcast, Techish.
Yeah.
As always, we love to hear from you, so use the hashtag Techish to jump into the discussion and let us know what you think. If you really like listening, why don't you jump into iTunes and leave us a review? You can always share this episode with a friend, or share it in your office, share it around Slack,
share it on social media,
share it away. And we'll be back soon.
Ciao. Bye.